Well, it's 10 o'clock. I think it's time for us to begin this session. We are now in session number 122. The title of this session is Grappling with Theodicy in Mormonism. Why does an all-knowing, all-loving, and all-powerful God permit evil and other bad things to happen? So we're going to be talking about the problem of evil. I mentioned to Michael that I think that's the Achilles heel of all Western religion. So I'm hoping that he's got the answer for us. Michael is a person I would describe as a true bibliophile. He was on a mission in Bolivia. He's taught gospel doctrine for a number of years. He has two master's degrees, one from BYU in history, the other from the University of Chicago, the Graduate Library School, in the history of the book. He's worked in a rare book library at Southern Methodist University in Dallas for a number of years, and he has his own rare book business that he has run for about 16 years. He has attended a seminar on Greco-Roman influences of the New Testament, taught at Tyndale House, which is affiliated with St. Edmund's College at Cambridge. And starting in 2007, he began a master's program in the Divinity School at Cambridge, at Darwin College specifically. So, we will turn the time to Michael. There is no respondent for this session, so when Michael is through, assuming there's time, we'll open it up for your questions and discussion. Michael.
Good morning. I like to walk around. I'm going to go ahead and use this. I'd like to just offer a brief invocation, those that would like to join me may. Father in heaven, we ask thee to please lift up the hearts of those that are heavy or broken today and help them to find the comfort that they're seeking and help us to be able to share with each other in a good spirit. And we ask this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Amen. So the problem, what I'd like to do is just spend a couple of minutes introducing the problem, and then I'd like to go through and have us just sort of, I'd like you to start thinking about the common responses that you hear to the problem of evil, or what you yourself feel like are some of the answers to that, and we'll list those up here on the board. And then as we're going through, we'll talk about some of these, and we'll go back through and spend more time on each of them. But I'd just like you to start thinking about the things that you've heard, why people say there's pain and suffering in the world, why evil exists. And so I'm going to go ahead and introduce it, and then we'll open that up and start talking about that. Classically, the problem was introduced... it's sort of a cliche to say that Leibniz, a philosopher in the 17th and 18th century, introduced the problem of theodicy by saying, you know, by posing the question, basically, if God exists, why is there evil in the world? If he's all-powerful and all-knowing, why is there evil and pain in the world? But really, the question has been around a lot longer than that. If you look in the Old Testament, the question was asked as well in the book of Job and other places. And even in the New Testament, you know, Savior, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was blinded? So the question has been there for a long time. What Leibniz changed was it, he changed it to if God exists. He put the if question into the philosophical problem. Before that, there was no question that God existed. It was just their relationship with God, why God would allow things like that to happen. The most popular response probably in the last 20 years has been from a Jewish rabbi, Harold Kushner, who wrote a book called Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And if I just take the 10-second summary of his book and tell you that basically what his answer boils down to is that God is not all-powerful, that he's all-loving but not all-powerful. And so you can't expect God to solve or step in and solve these problems, but only that you can expect his love. And that answer has resonated with a lot of people. His book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People, has sold millions and millions of copies. But I think, as LDS, we can go a little bit beyond that and grapple with it a little deeper. So we're going to go a little bit into the deep end of the doctrine pool today. And when I say that, I only mean to say we're not looking for shallow, easy answers. I do want to have all the ones listed that we've either heard or that we believe and treat those with respect. But I do think that it's a very serious problem, and I think I want to approach it in a respectful way.
but just make sure that we're going into it completely.
We have Bart Ehrman as a theology professor at the University of North Carolina, I believe, or Duke, and he wrote a book recently called God's Problem, you know, the problem of evil and pain and suffering in the world. And it's also a best-selling book, and sold a lot of copies of it. And what he says about theodicy and the problem of evil is, he says, it's a great conversation stopper at cocktail parties. He said, you go to a cocktail party, people ask you, what are you doing? You say, well, I'm writing a book to study why there's so much pain and suffering and misery in the world. He said, people look at you for about 10 seconds, and then they go, oh, it's nice to meet you, and they walk off. And I think there's a truth embedded in that statement, in that it's difficult to deal with. And especially if your life hasn't been touched in a particular way that's caused pain or suffering, that it's something that's difficult to understand. It's So what I'd like to begin right now is, first of all, the premise obviously here is that God is all-knowing and all-powerful. But we can talk about that in the discussion aspect as well, but I went ahead and I looked up a couple of LDS scriptures on it. You know, D&C 117, the Lord knows the calamities to come upon the earth. D&C 38, verse 2, all things are present before his eyes. And then as far as the all-powerful thing, the one that sums it up the best is indeed that famous section, D&C 132, that says, they shall be as gods because they have all power. So I don't think in the LDS theology that pretty much, I think it's pretty accepted. I'm open to other ideas as well, but I think it's pretty accepted that God is all-knowing and all-powerful. And so we go at it from that basis and then try to understand why there's evil, pain, and suffering in the world and why there's so much when it could seem preventable. So I'd like to open this up now to you and have you, let's go ahead and list some of the reasons why there's evil, pain, or suffering in the world. Let's just throw this out, and I'd like to hear them. Go ahead.
A free agency, and the Lord can't interfere with our free agency.
All right, so free agency, we're going to list that one first. And the fact that the Lord can't interfere with free agency, because if he did, we wouldn't be free agents any longer. We have one right behind you. Go ahead.
Keep on saying that you can't recognize good choices and or experience joy without also having the experience of pain and or seeing bad choices. So if the reason that evil exists is because without evil we would not recognize good.
Okay, so without evil we wouldn't know good. No evil, no good. We can also call that the bitter and sweet. This side, and we'll come back here, sir.
We don't know God very well. For example, we would say, well, if I were doing it, then I wouldn't allow this. So there's a certain amount of arrogance involved in our personas that we would take the place of God. We don't know God very well.
All right, so we don't know God very well, and there's a certain amount of arrogance and our presumption that we would know why God does things. So, I'm going to write arrogant up here, or try to. In our arrogant assumptions about God. Okay, go ahead.
There is no God.
All right. So if you go from the premise there's no God, then therefore there's nobody that's all-powerful or all-knowing, and therefore there's no reason to expect anyone to step in or intervene. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, at least not yet.
No God yet? Okay. All right. We'll list that one up here. So there's no God. That would certainly account for all the solutions to all the problems. That's a nice 10-second answer. Makes it very easy. We have one up here.
If our suffering is accepted with a certain degree of style, it ennobles us. Whereas pleasure, which we all tend to seek, debauches us, tends to debauch us.
All right, so what you're saying is there are different...
I'm quoting Bertrand Russell, but it's also my observation looking back on 8 years.
All right, so that there are different types of suffering is what you're saying. There's a self-inflicted type of suffering, or there's a suffering inflicted by others. Is that how you're making the distinction?
Well, I think evil and suffering enriches our experience.
Okay.
Because we have two supreme teachers, good and evil, and I don't know who's wise enough in here to know which has been the more effective. They're very powerful, but we tend to seek pleasure. I mean, give a man a lot of money and leisure and time, and he ends up seeking pleasure, which gives us so little. However, if we endure patiently our suffering, it ennobles us and refines us.
All right, so we have the
idea. Does that sound romantic?
Well, no, I think it's very easy to see that when people are given a lot of money, they go out and they buy boats and jet skis or whatever else to have pleasure with their lives, to seek something like that. Is that what you're referring to?
Chasing bikinis on the Riviera.
All right.
I mean, pleasure is pleasure.
All right.
But does it ennoble us?
Does it ennoble us? So suffering can enrich and ennoble us.
Yes.
Is what you believe. Okay.
If
we endure it with style.
Yeah.
All right.
Destroyed.
So the stylish manner of enduring suffering is what we're going to talk about in the next session. This is a good one.
All that
go ahead.
Talk of the refiner's fire. How else are we supposed to be tested? What other way is our mortality supposed to be defined?
So we have a test, a refiner's fire as well. So the test, the refiner's fire. Let's go with you, and then right behind there.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking that in a way, pain, it drives us to act the way thirst would drive us to drink. I mean, it's necessary for survival.
All right. So pain causes us to react to things. Do you mean that God causes pain so that we'll change in our lives?
Not
is that what you're saying?
Not that it causes it, but allows it to exist so that we can act, so that we can have drive to act.
All right, so that we have pain so that we can learn from it. Is that what you're saying? All right. Okay, so I'm trying to see if we've already got...
We
got free agency that we have to learn
thirst.
From.
Well, we don't have thirst in order to learn. We have thirst in order to drink so we can satisfy a need.
Is pain a need
so
that we have?
Pain is something that drives us to satisfy needs.
Okay, so pain would be satisfying. We need to satisfy some need to take care of the pain? Can you think of an example? I'll give you a minute if you want while I go to the response behind. I'm just trying to understand it better. Go ahead.
The necessity of opposition in all things.
All right, so opposition in all things kind of comes into the no evil, no good, the bitter, the sweet, but we'll put opposition up here too. That we have to have opposition in all things. That's something we're told. Go ahead, I'm back.
The idea that there is no evil.
Okay.
That evil does not exist.
That evil does not exist either?
Right. Mm-hmm.
All right. Can you speak up just a little bit? I'm sorry.
No, you got it. It's, there is no evil.
That there is no evil. Is there pain and suffering?
Not real pain and suffering. I guess what I'm thinking of is kind of a Descartes this idea where you have a kind of evil genius and pointing to things that really aren't real. I don't know, stretch the sentence.
Well, that's good. I appreciate it. So I like to stretch my mind and see other ways of seeing things. So the idea, we'll put that up here. With no evil, that evil doesn't exist, God doesn't, well, we put that with no God also. No evil, no God. Different aspects, but something to consider. Go ahead.
Well, out of suffering, a lot of advancements in science, or for instance, Lyapunov, because of a little girl who was taken. So sometimes we are motivated by our suffering to create something that will be for the benefit of mankind.
All right, so sometimes our suffering causes some positive change to happen in the world. In your instance of the child that was kidnapped and then the resulting Amber Laws was your example of that. So some good can come out of suffering. Is that why you think God allows it then? Because good will come out of it sometimes? Sure, you're just stating that that's an outcome of it, so that there can be good that comes out of the out of evil, pain, or suffering. Go ahead.
I think not necessarily that
pain and suffering are a punishment, but I think sometimes they're a natural consequence. If you put your hand on the flame, then you're going to get burned. So I think that.
Okay, so somebody that is an alcoholic and drinks and then suffers liver disease as a result of that, is that what you would see as some pain and suffering that was self-caused by them?
I think at least physically, I do think that we do experience pain and suffering from consequences of our choices.
Okay, so some, we'll just put self up here. I hope everyone remembers what all these abbreviations are. So some is self-inflicted. Go ahead.
All of these assumptions are saying that God, in fact, causes or allows what happens. The more basic question is, then, can you get God off the hook from causing all the pain that kills and destroys people in the world and makes it such an ugly world? And, you know, the only way you get to that is by saying God is also bound by law, which precedes him, and so he is limited. But the only way you can escape this law.
Well, I think that's very good. Let's consider that for a minute. This is really getting to the nub of what we're talking about. If you go through and you look at the LDS scriptures, you'll see time and time again that the Lord chastens his servants, that he causes trials and suffering. Originally, I was going to entitle this session, Does God Own Suffering? Does he accept the responsibility for it? It's something that we can think about. Let's go ahead and get everyone's responses to it, but we're going to be coming back to that, and I'd like to have people think. We have someone on this side that had their hand up, then we'll come back. If they still want to
say the same thing, you know, for natural disasters, essentially that God's bound by whatever universals. And so I guess you get to the definition of omnipotent.
All right, so it's the definition of all powerful then, whether or not God is all powerful, that dictates whether or not he can actually respond in those circumstances. Let me just throw something out for you to consider. What about the people that talk of a natural disaster and then they come out of it and they say, God saved my life? God stepped in and intervened. And sometimes they have some miraculous story to tell of some intervention from heaven or someplace that is otherwise unaccountable. And they're saved. And yet somebody else in the same disaster is also killed and dies. Just think about that. I just want to point out the fact that it's a very complex issue, that there aren't really easy answers that we like to think that there are sometimes.
Not that it's a Mormon tradition, but as I understand the Buddhist teachings, all of this life that we are involved in which we see suffering, is simply an illusion. That the ultimate reality is a much higher consciousness, which then makes this all of a dream, if you will. In which case, the problem no longer exists because this is not really reality.
All right, so
that's kind of
getting
back to the
no evil,
the no God, no evil, as to why that
no reality,
a viable explanation.
But I think anybody that has actually suffered knows how real it actually feels in their life. That the pain is real, the suffering is real, and the consequences are real. The punishment, whether it's the death penalty for a crime or whatever it happens to be, is real as well.
Getting back to your original question, I would say one of the reasons for evil or pain is to teach us how to make choices. I look at that, suffering enriches. Sometimes suffering embitters.
Okay.
And we can make the choice whether it enriches us and we learn from it, or whether it just turns us off and says to hell with it.
All right. So suffering can enrich us or embitter us. And so what you're saying, that the choice is ours on how we respond to the suffering, so that we have a choice in response. I think that sounds good in theory, but I think for someone who's brokenhearted or someone who's suffered a devastating loss, it's a little tougher to grapple with. And I think that's a personal response. Let's go ahead and take yours and we'll have yours.
That's the problem that I see for my relationship with God is, I had a conversation which I said, you know, because my daughter is no longer a member of the LDS Church, and I said, well, you know, this friend of ours, this baby is being blessed. Does that mean that blessing means that baby is going to do well and this one is going to die? And she said, well, no, that doesn't mean anything. And so she said, just because it's less doesn't mean it's not going to have folly happen to it. And so what do you say? The question is, what does God, what relationship, when does, like you said, when does God let somebody live, you know, and then let all these other people die?
We had a personal response. I mean, I think it's an excellent question. Sometimes we just come to learn what the questions are. And I know, I hope that doesn't seem like a letdown to anybody that was hoping for the quick answer. But sometimes we just come to learn what the questions are. And you'll see what I mean at the end of the session. As I think there is one great transformative question that God is going to give everyone at some point in their life. And we'll get to that in a minute. I want to relate a little bit more about this story of why God saves some people and not others. And our own Lord, we had our bishop, our current bishop, we live in Star Valley, my wife and I do, and he was in a snowmobile accident. Snowmobiling, there's not much else you can do in Star Valley in the wintertime. A lot of the fellows snowmobile, and he was out snowmobiling before he was bishop, and in the snow, he got caught in an avalanche. Now, you could be killed in an avalanche that isn't much bigger than your car. It's just the power of the snow covering you up. You don't know, you're disoriented, you don't know which way is up. In a matter of minutes, you lose your breath. Now, they have devices to help save people, beacons, and they actually have a bag that's supposed to inflate to give you like 30 minutes of air to breathe now when you're hit by something like that, but they don't always work. Nevertheless, he was right at the point where he was angry at the rescuers because he was feeling so good. He was at some point where he was transitioning when he was rescued. And he gets up and bears his testimony that he was rescued, which is great. Now, in another ward in our valley, in January this year, we had three men. One was on the high council. They were all active, all stalwarts in the ward that were out snowmobiling. They weren't high marking. High marking is where you take the snowmobile up and you try to see how high you can go on a hill. High marking is a good way to cause avalanches if the snow is loose. But they weren't doing anything like that. They were just going down the trail, and a freak avalanche occurred. Like what they called it, a 50-year avalanche. And this particular avalanche buried and killed all three of them. It was on a Saturday morning, and they were just starting out, going out to snowmobile, and everybody was devastated. One of them was my doctor, and left behind young children. In a small valley like that, you learn to know everyone pretty soon, and it touches you very personally when something like that happens. And so, ironically, in the same sacrament meeting where someone, the fast and testimony meeting, someone was getting up and talking about basically the bishop being saved, somebody else had gotten up and spoken about these other three men that weren't saved. Did God love them any less? Or was God just pointing them out to die? Does he have angels that go around that, you know, okay, it's your time now, here comes the avalanche, we're going to kill you off? These are just questions. But I think they go to the heart of the suffering and the issue. I mean, it's a very real thing. If you haven't experienced a personal loss in your life, if you haven't suffered personally to the point where you question whether or not God existed, I think you're going to have a harder time grappling with these questions than someone that has. And I only say that from the point of knowing. Go ahead.
Just a quick comment. We're kind of social idiots. Like, we didn't learn what your friend learned about cocktail parties. And so we bring this subject up on almost every date night we go. With any couple, that's why we have no friends now. Actually, some of our only friends are here.
Yeah, my wife and I will volunteer.
But people in my ward and extended community, almost all of them have very simple answers to this that they are very, they have strong conviction in it that provide no solace to me. But I just wondered if you have discovered that too, that there's. And they don't have any problem with that disparity coming from the pulpit. That the same person that's, like we walk out just grinding our teeth after something like that has been stated at the pulpit, and everyone else is fine with it. We seem to be the exceptions.
You may have had something personal in your life that touches you in a way that the others haven't yet. And I think that's the definition of experience that makes it hard to communicate something like this, is that we have everyone in this room. Perhaps some of them have something like that that's been so devastating in their lives that they've grappled with the idea of whether or not God even exists anymore or why God isn't listening to them. And yet for the other side that feels so blessed in their lives, someone who says, it would be very easy to be arrogant without realizing it in the church by saying, well, we brought up our children the right way. We read our scriptures every morning. This is what happened to us. And, you know, this is, and they attribute the outcome that they have for their children to what they did instead of realizing that it was probably just their children, actually. So I'm trying to just let you know that I do understand and I know how deep that goes. And it's just an example of the, I did this same symposium out at Sunstone West in California. And one of the responses that I got out there was that, well, what you need to know, and this was the answer that she probably gave traditionally, and her short answer was, she pointed her finger at me and she said, you need to know that all these problems that you're talking about are just specks in the timeline of God. God's infinite and eternal. You're talking about something that's, you know, microcosms, just microseconds in God's plan of infinity, and that's why they happen. And I thought, oh, okay, well, that's one way to look at it. Let's, we had a lot of hands, so I didn't mean to ignore. Let's start at the back, and we'll come up to the front. Go ahead, you can start.
Oh, I know people always say my friend, but this really isn't me. But a friend of mine mentioned, and I can't remember if this happened when she was on her mission or she read it, but anyway, she was, whoever this person was in the MTC, and one of the teachers, I'm not bad on missions, I don't know how this works, but anyway, made a comment that he was told by the Spirit that there was a missionary in the congregation who had been masturbating. I mean, not right up in there, but seriously.
You wouldn't need the Spirit to tell you that if it was.
But anyway, as such, he was not worthy to serve a mission. Okay. Now, I'm not making this up. This is honestly the truth. And that, okay, she says, well, why was that person given, that leader given the inspiration to know that and to talk with the person and try and help him, whatever. But what about the temple ordinance worker, the veil worker, who was sexually molesting his children? Why weren't the authorities given the inspiration to know that was occurring?
I think that brings up a very good problem. It kind of ties into what people are trying to solve here. We sometimes come up with a quick answer, but what about the temple worker, whoever it is, that's sexually molesting his children, and yet nobody seems to receive the inspiration to point to him and say, you shouldn't be here any longer, you're not worthy. And why do the children have to endure that suffering?
I think one of the answers that I hear most commonly at funerals, you know, where suffering actually leads to death, is that there was some purpose beyond the veil. Somebody was taken because they were needed more somewhere else. And it seems to fit whether they're little children or older, but it's this beyond the veil.
So we have the idea of the purpose beyond the veil. That's kind of an easy out, actually, but it's a very popular one, probably for that reason. That we have, you know, you can just kind of say, well, they had some purpose beyond the veil. That's why they died. Well, it does bring comfort, and that's not always a bad thing. Dealing with the loss and suffering is hard enough as it is.
I'm reminded of a town on the East Coast that had a hurricane heading for it. So they were all asked to pray to God to stop the hurricane. So they prayed, and the hurricane turned. And went to another town and killed I don't know how many people. Then they were all asked to pray to thank God that the hurricane didn't hit them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he says, spare me, you know? I mean, what kind of faith is that?
Well, I think that's a great point. You have the town with the hurricane, you pray, and it really ties into the story about the snowmobiles and the avalanche.
Yeah.
Is that God? Is that really the God that we believe in, that he would turn the hurricane from one town just to send it to another? I think if we thank God for saving somebody, then we also implicate God for not saving somebody else. And I think that's what we have to consider.
The problem with theodicy has a general assumption, which is if you accept that God is all-powerful, the assumption is then his purpose of having that power should be used to eliminate or curtail suffering or eliminate evil in the world, which raises the question, well, since we don't see that, why doesn't God do that? So there is the notion of, should God, being all-powerful, do anything about the suffering in the world? is at the root of that. And an obvious LDS response would be, no, because of our free agency, it's up to us to do something about that evil or that suffering. We are committed by our baptismal covenant to mourn with those who mourn and comfort those that are stand in need of comfort, to quote Alma. So that it's up to us to do something. So the fact that it occurs is simply an opportunity for us to engage in alleviating that situation. The fact that we don't do that, or we don't engage entirely always in doing that, is simply the result of why there's so much.
All right, I think that ties into some very good things to throw out and consider for a minute. Maimonides was a Jewish philosopher, a rabbi in the medieval times, and he thought that there were three basic reasons that there was evil in the world. There was natural disasters, there were those that people brought on themselves, and then those that were caused by God. And I think one of the things that we're talking about here, when we think about the idea of free agency, and we think about, does God have an obligation to intervene if he is all-powerful, really is where, which was mentioned earlier, this question is taking us. Let me throw it out to you in a different way, and we'll just take some responses on it. If God is bound by the same laws that we are bound by, laws of chastity, things like that, laws of being kind, loving others, and if God sees something, if we see something and we don't do anything to intervene in it, whether it's a child being abused or rescuing someone when we could have rescued them, are we guilty of a sin of omission by not doing that? Is God guilty of a sin of omission when he doesn't intervene? And he could have intervened. So I'll just throw that out, because really that comes down to what we're talking about in two of the comments that were made here. And I think they're worth grappling with for a little while. Let's see what...
It kind of sounds like to me that you're talking about moral evil, and then you're talking about natural evil. Now I can see where free agency enters into moral evil, but I cannot see where free agency enters into natural evil. But the question that I have too is, that God is known to have destroyed nations, so is God himself the author of evil?
All right, so God is known to have destroyed nations before, and certainly that's one of the premises. It wasn't mentioned here, but in the Old Testament, one of the premises for the presence of evil and suffering in the world is that God punishes those who sin, and then if you sin, you'll be punished. And that was very prevalent in the Old Testament. Jesus seemed to step away from that and move away from that. But certainly it was there.
And it's in the Book of Mormon, City of Ammoni.
All right. It's in the Book of Mormon as well. It's sort of the Old Testament idea of the God will punish the sinners by destroying their countries.
Well, aside from going with the no-God theory that lets everything off, obviously, if we truly believe we live forever, forever's a long time. A really long time. So maybe God isn't as involved in it as we might think, and that after living forever, maybe just having experience in all kinds of things might, I don't know, cause something short of, you know, boring. You know, good all the time might get boring, so maybe we just need experience.
Alright, so I think you're coming into the timeline thing, where you talk about in God's version of time and eternity and forever versus ours, which is really just one small slice of it. So maybe this earth is sort of a preparatory state, is what you're saying, for a lot of intense and eternal suffering to come in the world to come.
I'm not saying preparatory at all. I'm not saying preparatory.
Okay.
I'm saying given
if you live
forever and you got bored, I don't know, maybe just have an experience.
Well, this reminds me, you've probably all seen the comic of where the couple in the Celestial Kingdom, he's in a white suit reading a newspaper, sitting in the easy chair, and she's ironing a lot of white clothes behind him, and she goes, I don't know, somehow I just thought it was going to be different.
More along that line, rather than
just go to the back.
I, in a strange way, admire the people in my ward and community who have that. As much as it drives me crazy and doesn't satisfy me, there's simple answers. Even for people, my visiting teacher had home with four young children when she got a call that her husband had been struck by lightning in his fishing boat and fell out and drowned. She has simple answers, using it on the other side, that satisfy her. And she goes on not being embittered. If this happens to me, I would be so furious at that God and his omission. I'm down here full of anger toward my child with severe disability, and okay. And then there are people around me who are, the woman I visit teach was traveling on whatever the highway to go see the musical Wicked that I suggested she go see on her vacation with her little 5-year-old to go to Disneyland, her husband had cheated on her and do a number of things. And a semi cut them off and killed her daughter last September, her only girl. She has answers, she's not angry. She has answers that satisfy her that are just completely inconsistent for me and have no thought. But she's not angry.
Well, I think that's a...
Turn our minds off and stop. Go home and not
be I think you're right. The ones that can do that and that are comforted, I certainly don't want to deny them their comfort because it's something precious that they can hang on to. I mean, it is a precious gift for them to have something like that, and if that's what does it for them, that's great. They're probably not here in this room. And so... For those that do wonder, that's who I'm just trying to reach out and listen to today is, you know, I don't think, I said at the beginning that there are easy answers to this. There are easy answers, and if there were easy answers, you probably wouldn't be here listening to these today. But these are for the people that struggle, who want to understand and are reaching for something. Let's go in the far back.
Our couple of questions that I have are, we brought up cause and effect, and it's easy as a parent to say, if I teach my child to read, okay, now they know how to read, cause, effect. But then when you see a lot of things your kids do, you wonder, okay, did I cause that? You wonder where, you know, how, and in all areas of life, how much is cause and effect, and where does that end into something not, you know, within my control or cause? And then the second comment goes, question goes back to the hurricane issue, or the passing the hurricane from the town, because maybe because the next session is about the Ramey Museum, but oh, wait, no. I'm mixing my stories. Tower of Babel, right? Wasn't there a phrase in the Bible that says, I'm going to mix up your languages because there's nothing you can't do? Once all these people are united, there's nothing you can't do. And that really stuck with me. I mean, I suppose if everyone is in power, you know, bringing to mind this hurricane is going to pass us by, it's possible they did cause that. So my question not only is, what about the power of God, what about the power of our power? You know, for good or for evil, if we're united or if we're, you know, prayer being in focused thought, creation again, thought being creation, how much power do we have?
All right, so your comment comes into two parts, actually. I like what Epictetus, who was a Roman philosopher, had to say about parents and children. He said, parents take too much credit when their children do well and too much blame when their children do wrong.
Yeah.
You know, really, and that's where that comes in from. And then the question about the power is interesting. If we believe in the power of the priesthood, if we believe that we have that power, the power of God to act, we have to ask ourselves, how accountable are we for not exercising the power when we could have? To intervene or to help someone or to do something, are we accountable as well? Our own personal fallacies.
I guess the one little sliver that I wanted to add there is it's easy to say, okay, we're praying for a good cause, quote unquote, yeah, that was the power of prayer. But isn't it just as likely if there's power in that intention that we can also create evil with our concentrated intention? Because if not, again, you're blaming God for awarding only prayers towards good cause. You know, you're again putting God in the picture to monitor and only answer prayers ultimately.
That's certainly one of the harder questions that comes out of it. Let's go ahead.
Okay. Power can be many kinds of power. We're talking about special effects here, I think. People like in Monty Python, God throws his arm and explosions happen. But what if God can only start root objective processes, and God is basically subjective and persuasive. And if you listen, God is always helping. But you do the work.
All right, so what if God is only able to lend help and love and support, but not actually able to intervene and stop the processes? Is that what you're saying? And that certainly, that goes back to what Rabbi Kushner said as well. That was his vision of God. And I think some people, that's a comfortable notion. I do believe that God is all-loving. The problems that we're grappling with is if we think he's all-powerful as well. And that's, if he's not all-powerful, then it makes it easier to accommodate to.
But I'm a process theologian, so...
Process works well. You and Dan Weatherspoon can bring in the whole process thing. I'd love to see more on that. Those that don't know process theology, I'll give you the non-informed version. And you can talk to this person or to Dan or somebody and find out more about it. Basically, the idea that God does love, but God is not powerful. And I think it came from Alfred North Whitehead, was sort of the founder of process theology.
The other problem, of course, is when you start assuming that God has blessed you. He has given you things to give someone else.
All right.
Now, all of a sudden, all of these people that have these terrible things happening to them, it's because God chose not to bless them. But he did choose to bless you.
Yes.
Now, that opens a can of worms.
It does, so we don't have time for it right now. But that's going to be next year's session, and we're going to look forward to hearing from you on it. I have to conclude right now. We're almost out of time. But I want to thank you from my heart for what you shared with me today, because I've learned from each one of you. C.S. Lewis wrote a book early after he converted to Christianity. And he wrote a book called The Problem of Pain. And it's the type of book that you would expect from C.S. Lewis, and the type of reason that C.S. Lewis gets quoted more than any other non-Mormon in General Conference. But then later, after C.S. Lewis had married a woman who left her husband for him, and she was diagnosed with cancer, and then in the process of being diagnosed with cancer, she received a ministration from ministers at her bedside and was basically told that she would be cured of her cancer. That her cancer would be healed. And this was a great gift to him, and he felt very thankful for it. And 2 years later, she died with the cancer. Her name was Joy. C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Grief Observed after that experience, and he didn't sign his own name to it. He used a pseudonym. And it was quite a different book than the first book on the problem of pain. In A Grief Observed, where he suffers this devastating loss, literally the love of his life, the one person that he felt like he called her his student, his lover, his best friend, just... she was everything in the world to him. And this is what he has to say about how he felt after she died, when he was trying to grapple with this idea of her loss and with God. He felt betrayed by scriptures such as, "Knock and it shall be opened unto you." But he thought that kicking the door like a madman was not the same as knocking. "I had been gradually coming to feel that the door was no longer shut and bolted. Was it my own frantic need that slammed it in my face? The time when there is nothing at all in your soul except a cry for help may be just the time that God can't give it. Perhaps even God cannot give us something if we lack the capacity to receive it at that time." Now I want to have you think about what he went through and his experience and compare that to Jesus on the cross. Jesus knew that he was going to go through suffering and pain. At one point, Peter rebukes him and says, "No, Master, it won't be like this for you." And he's like, "Get thee behind me, Satan. I do have to go through this pain and this suffering that's coming ahead of me." It's very interesting that on the cross, where Jesus is hung, after all of his suffering and after all of his torments, that he also experiences abandonment from God. That he also experiences the feeling of rejection. And he says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" in Aramaic. Now it's interesting, just 2 days earlier when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, he called God Abba in Aramaic, which is Father. But here he calls him Eloi, which is a more formal distance. It's like the formal word for God. He's no longer Father to him at this point because he's been abandoned and left by him. And I think that perhaps I would like to suggest that that is the transformative question that God has for us sometimes in our lives. When we reach the point where we feel abandoned by God and feel forsaken, if you think about how Jesus taught in the scriptures, he thought through questions. Why would God, the Father, teach any differently than that through questions? And that is the ultimate question that I can come up with, the one that Jesus himself had to go through. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you left me to suffer here? I just want to leave that thought with you to consider and think about. I do appreciate everything that you shared with me today. And I hope that you will find some peace and some joy
and somewhere some happiness in your life to help lift you up and help carry you on this road. And I leave that with you. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Michael, for a very stimulating and thought-provoking session. We are at the concluding moment, so thank you for being in attendance, and I'm sure Michael would be glad to chat with you for a little while if you have further details to pursue.